Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Could a change in perspective affect the way you feel about this planet we call home? Even the most well-traveled among us are limited to a fairly close-up view of things, even if we do get a glimpse occasionally out the window of a commercial airliner. As a career astronaut, my guest realized he was in a very privileged position to see more. And in his last long-duration orbit, he set about to capture the beauties of the Earth too vast to be appreciated from within the atmosphere. Chris Hadfield has made multiple trips into space, including a five-month tour in late 2012 and early 2013 aboard the International Space Station. He served there as commander. All told, he has taken about 45,000 photographs from space and culled his favorite into a new book called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Just about every inch of the Earth has been mapped now, but this project is a reminder of how much of it remains unknown to us.
Yeah, there's a big difference between maps and reality, between a pastel-colored, two-dimensional representation of something and what you actually see with your eyes and what you feel when you see those things with your eyes. And as you say, I've over the three space flights, having had a chance to see the world directly so many times, I've been around it almost 2,600 times, you get quite a different view than maps. Maps almost become sort of childlike compared to the view that soaks in through your eyes constantly.
You write that you never got tired of looking out the window when the opportunity presented itself. How different is the view each time, even if you might be looking at the same piece of land?
Yeah, people ask, boy, it must be boring up on the space station. It makes me laugh. But boring? Wow, come to the window with me. And maybe the part that isn't obvious to folks is we're going incredibly fast. We go from L.A. to New York in about 9 minutes. So even though you say, oh, it might be, you're just going over the same place again, but you go around the entire world every 92 minutes. And so even if you're focusing on a place, it's very different than looking out the window of the airliner, as you mentioned in the opener, where you look out the window and then you have a sip of coffee and look at your magazine, and you look out the window and it's still Kansas. But if you are on a spaceship, you look out the window, and then if you have a sip of coffee, then you're on the other side of the country. And you can't keep up. You can't soak up all the stuff that you're seeing and the scope of it, the span of it, and the fact that you're up there long enough that the seasons change and the weather changes and the angle between you and the sun and the earth is constantly changing. So it's right on the edge of what you can even appreciate. And that's why I took those 45,000 pictures, because I wanted later on to maybe try and let my emotions and thoughts catch up with the with everything that had poured by in front of my eyes.
Can you actually feel that speed in a palpable way? I mean, it's not like you're hitting turbulence. Other than the speed with which the scenery is changing, what's the experience of that like?
No, our fastened seatbelt light never comes on the space station. It's always weightlessly, elegantly smooth. You don't really get a sense of speed because it's so inexorable. You're just silently steaming along. And even though conceptually you're going 18,500 miles an hour, there's no rush of trees whipping by or the sound of the wind. The only time, Chris, that I really felt the speed of it was if I took a big camera and looked straight down and sort of held it still. And I mean, you're going 5 miles a second. Hmm. So then you really see a whole city just whip on by, go from one side of Dallas to the other, in just a few seconds, and then you're past it. So staring through a soda straw of a camera lens, you get sort of that ground rush feeling. But as soon as you pull it away from your eyes and just see from horizon to horizon, from overhead Dallas, you can start to see New York City, that type of distance, then you lose the ground rush, but you get the sense of perspective and how it all actually fits together so differently than just a map.
When you're in a space like the ISS, is your perception that the Earth is below you or that it's above you, or does that really become immaterial when everybody is weightless?
What a cool question. It it's an unusual thing to think about when you live sort of in two dimensions like we do on Earth, where we're always stuck to the floor. On the space station, your life is inside a bunch of aluminum tubes, like you're living in a cylindrical trailer park for your whole life, where you just go from one trailer to another through little doors. But if you come through what is essentially our kitchen in Node 1, and you turn and you go into Node 3, you go floating past the treadmill that we exercise on, and then the toilet, and then the exercise equipment. And then if you turn and go down into the floor, there's this like a big well, and you go down into the floor, and that well is a huge bulging window, like a gigantic transparent barnacle on the bottom of the station. You pull yourself down into that, and what's bizarre about it is you're pulling yourself down towards the world, and even though you just pulled yourself down into the floor, suddenly your body says, because your head's down, says, oh, the world is above me, and you feel like suddenly you're looking up at the world. It's disconcerting. It's not natural. It's not what you're used to on Earth. But your body immediately decides, since it's above the top of your head, then you're looking up at the world. And that's how it seems, which makes moon rises really interesting, because if the world is above you, then that means the moon falls away from the world. It's like every time the moon rises, it's like the Earth laid an egg, like this little tiny glowing boop, and it should almost make a little popping noise, because the moon comes squirting out of the Earth and goes scuttling off out of your sight as we come racing around the planet.
I've also thought about this when you are circumnavigating the globe so often in the course of a 24-hour day, how you must get sort of divorced from day and night in a way that disconnected from that, from the way you've always lived the rest of your life. What does that feel like?
Yeah, Earth, the day-night patterns on the Earth become more of a spectacle than a definition of time. You go into and out of the day and night so quickly that it's more like, how is Earth illuminated right now so that I can see it better? You come into the dark and suddenly you can see the whole glow of the eastern seaboard or the Nile, where the brightness of all the people that live along the Nile, and then the big triangle of Cairo and Alexandria at the end of it. It shows up so beautifully at night that you don't really think of it as night and day. You just think of it as this is the part of the world, and the sun is over there, so this is the shadow. You know, it's as if someone was holding a huge flashlight on a basketball that doesn't define night or day for you anymore, that just defines which parts are lit. And we self-regulate on board as to what's day and night. We decide. We had to choose a time zone. We just chose Greenwich Mean Time, same as London, England, sort of a good compromise. So when the when the queen is going to bed, we're going to bed. And on the space station, though, we sort of honor it. And we have the lights up bright during the day. And then when I was commander, when it got to be dark, I would shut off most of the lights on the station. You want to leave enough on that if you have an emergency, you can respond to it. But we sort of would dim things down, so it gave that familiar human feeling of darkness when it's time to go to bed.
I think we've all seen the stunning but now familiar composite shots of the Earth from space, right, in which multiple images are sort of digitally stitched together to make this impossibly cloudless view of the planet. What's so delightful about this book is that you went in for, if the word is right, close-up shots of places, and you discovered really amazing things.
It is an amazing perch. I've sort of described it as I had the best tripod in the world. you're floating. Picture what it feels like. You're floating weightless. So your body's sort of drifting around. So you take your toes and you hook them into the hatch that might close to cover up this big bulging window, the cupola. So you got your toes wedged. So your body's just more sort of gently waving like a leaf, pivoting at your toes. And then you've got a camera in your hands and your head down towards the world. And now you're looking. And you're just watching to see what you see. And your head pivots around like a little bird. You know, you're looking to see something. And then suddenly you'll catch a glimpse, of a glint of sunlight off of something. Or just because of the speed, something will roll into view. Or you'll be staring at something. You realize, wow, that looks just like whatever. That looks just like a snowman's head. Or that looks just like a wolf. Or that looks whatever. And you bring up the camera and you look at it. And then you wait for the angle between you and the Earth and the Sun to bring it out to its maximum relief. And then you take a few pictures and then you move on to the next thing. And then you take that little chip out of the camera and put it in your zippered pocket. And you, every chance you get during the day, you do that. And by the end of the day, you've got a whole pocket full of the world. And then you plug it in the computer that night when you're supposed to be asleep and try and whip through as many pictures as you can to see and send them all down to NASA. And then you do it again the next day.
There are so many remarkable photographs in the book, but one that I just can't get enough of is this picture that you have of the Rio Negro in Brazil. Can you describe that image for us?
Is that the one that's a sort of a glowing silver?
Yes, it's like liquid silver. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny that it's called Rio Negro, right? That one was fascinating. It's because so much of Brazil is feeding the Amazon, and so there's the huge, broad, flat, languid brown waters, or in that case, even blackish waters. But if what you have to remember, and you make sure you remember this next time you're on a spaceship, but remember to look back towards the sun, because if you wait till just the right moment, and you can occasionally see this at an airliner window as well, but if you wait for just the right moment, the sun, as if someone were holding some enormous mirror and flashing it at you, the sun will reflect off the surface water of the world just for a second, and then it'll be gone. And so I was looking back at that river, and it's a big, broad, sort of as if someone had braided a bunch of hair on the river, looking back at it, and the sun started glinting at one end. So I had the camera, and I started going click, 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 waiting for the best lit part of it. And it takes, depending on the wind that day, how reflective the surface of the water is, because, you know, if it's rippled, the sun will reflect very differently. But that particular day, the sun came off it at just the right angle, and it's as if someone had magically, instantaneously turned this huge river to liquid silver or to mercury or something. And just for a second, this river just blasted this rich, flowing silver color at me, and I took some pictures of it, and then it was gone. Then it was back to what it normally looked like, just a big languid river. But the picture fortunately showed that fleeting moment, and it was like a little secret. And the world had showed me. They just say, hey, if you look carefully, guess what I'm going to show you next. And that's sort of how it feels all the way around the world.
Is it ever quiet aboard the ISS, or is there always like a hum of machinery and oxygen tanks and that sort of thing?
It's noisy, unfortunately. The space station, some areas are really noisy. The noisiest thing's the toilet. It makes a racket with all the, you know, because it has centrifuges and fans and pumps. But even just the ambient noise, it's about the same as riding in the back of just a regular bus, you know, because without gravity, we have to have forced air. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you'd end up with pockets of breathed up air with, you know, carbon dioxide or whatever. So we're constantly pushing the air around deliberately to make sure that it's healthy. And so there's fans, and then pumps have to work a little harder because the water behaves differently. It sticks to the sides of the pipe. So it's noisy. The quietest place on the station is actually in the little bedrooms. They're carefully insulated from noise. And all the music that I recorded on the space station, I turned my little sleep pod into a tiny little recording studio and get it nice and quiet. And I'd stick a sign on the outside that said, you know, recording in session, so people wouldn't make a racket going by. And then I'd turn the fan down to its absolute lowest, just enough to keep me healthy in there. And even though, it sure wasn't recording studio quality. It's a wonderful place to record music, but it's not whisper silent. It's just magnificently beautiful.
Chris Hadfield is with us. He is an astronaut and former commander of the International Space Station. He has a new book out called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
10, 9, to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Detach from station and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirts you wear.
That is my guest, astronaut Chris Hadfield, former commander of the International Space Station, in the what became a viral sensation online. We're talking about his new book, You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. So, Chris, people just loved the fact that you recorded that from space. It went everywhere. It is, as a choice of songs, on the one hand, it's perfect. On the other hand, it is so lonely and depressing. Did it get to you at all?
Well, initially, that was exactly my reaction. In fact, it was sort of a viral request. As soon as folks discovered there was a musician on board, because my brother and I had written a Christmas carol that we recorded, and I got there just before Christmas. So I'd recorded this song, and my son had released it onto SoundCloud. And then as soon as people heard there was someone up there with a guitar, there was this internet clamoring to, hey, you got to cover Space Oddity, Major Tom. And my reaction was just like, yours, really? That's a depressing song, and the astronaut dies at the end. Why would I record that song? But my son, who's in his late 20s, said, hey, Dad, you're not recording this for you. You're recording this for everybody else. Just do it. So, but being a father, you know, I negotiated with him. I said, okay, well, tell you what, Evan, if you rewrite the words so that the astronaut lives at the end, then I'll record it. And so we changed the words so it's not so bleak, and the astronaut returns to Earth having really lived the experience. But you're right, the response has been huge. I mean, just on the site where my son posted it, it's been seen almost 25 million times. And with all the rebroadcasts, I don't know, it's hundreds of millions of times around the world. Pretty amazing.
So when you are circling the Earth in a spacecraft, you can see some evidence, slight evidence of human activity. There are a few man-made structures that are visible. But you cannot see anything like a person, an animal, moving around. You describe the Earth as looking like a still life.
Yeah, it's really rare. You're going fast, but you're crossing over things so quickly that there's not time for them to change in front of your eyes. Even a fire. We had some pretty big fires in the outback of Australia. It was the heat of their summer when we launched. And there were big, raging fires. And you could catch, if you look closely, you could catch the color of the flame. The fires were so big. But you couldn't get any motion. Everything looked like a snapshot of what was happening. There were only a couple times that I saw motion, and they were to do with airplanes, where if an airplane was pulling a contrail or an aerobatic team, like in this case, the Canadian aerobatic team, the military one, the Snowbirds, they were doing a practice, and all nine of them were trailing smoke. And they're going several hundred miles an hour, and I could actually see this, like someone had this magic white highlighter marker, and they were drawing this line on the surface of the world that was getting longer as I was watching it. It made me laugh because suddenly the world was alive underneath me. I could actually see something physically happening, not just frozen for a moment in time. It was a really rare thing to see, though.
Is it eerie to pass over the Earth? And I mean, you've got, you know, constant communication with, you know, headquarters and all that, but is it strange?
I think eerie is in the eye, or is in the mind of the beholder, probably. It's more magnificent than eerie. And you get a sense of the motion just because you come around again so quick. You know, 92 minutes, yeah. You're back, you're around the world, and it's turned underneath you, so you get a little different angle and a little bit of a different track. And if you were looking at a big thunderstorm, by the time you come around 92 minutes later, it's evolved or gone or moved. You can see lightning, of course, from space as well, and it at nighttime, it lights up enormous storms like some great incandescent light bulb that is magnificent to look at. So it's not so much a feeling of eeriness. Really, Chris, it's more like a feeling of honor and privilege and a rare chance that you are getting to see something straight out the window with your eyes that is almost unknown in the human experience. And that's one of the reasons we take the pictures, and it's the main reason I put this book together, was to try and not keep that experience just to myself, but to share it the best way I could.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mark in Fort Worth. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. Fascinating show today. Thanks so much. I have a suggestion for you on the title of your next book. You said Pocket Full of the World, and wow, it just the imagery is amazing. And
yeah,
I can see why you're a songwriter,
Mark,
as well.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's the best type of trick or treating, I think, to have collected the treats that the world gave you all day, and then when you get home back to your little sleep station, and just before bed to flick through them and see what you really got, and then try and resolve, okay, next time I come around, I really want to get that picture where I put the Golden Gate Bridge. I want to set it a little bit to the left so you get Alcatraz in the middle, whatever, you know. I was thinking about it. There's almost an intimacy with the world that develops, as if each time around it said, oh, you thought you saw stuff last time? Wait till I show you some stuff this time, because you get better at seeing it and you know where to look and what to look for. So I have this sort of relationship with the world in my pocket.
Are you having to check weather reports the entire time? Like, oh, maybe a storm's blowing in over San Francisco and you're not going to get the Golden Gate Bridge today.
On my first two flights, Chris, I did that because they were short flights. They were 8 days or 11 or 12 days. And so weather was everything, because if it happened to be a weather system moving into that part of the world, then I knew, man, I've only got a couple days chance to get a picture of this. If I don't get it, it's gone. On the space station, though, where the six people are living up there right now, you have the incredible privilege of saying, it's cloudy, I'll take a picture of that next month, you know, or 2 months from now. And so at first I was checking the weather reports. Oh, man, it's going to be cloudy. But then I realized you just need to be more fatalistic about the weather and not worry about what you can't see, but take the time to take pictures of what is actually there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Scott in Dallas. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Go. Commander, as a hobbyist photographer and a space enthusiast, I just have to say, number one, I appreciate what you do, and it's a great honor to talk to you today.
Thanks, Scott.
I'm just curious, just purely on a space level, what your moment of greatest fear or concern was in your time on the ISS, if there was any specific incident that really sticks out in your mind.
Yeah, fear and concern are sort of two different things. Astronauts are always concerned, and we're hardly ever fearful. Yeah, I think that's the way people want us to be. We should have a thoughtful, ready expression on our face, not one of abject terror. So we try and be one and not the other, and we do that through getting ready for years and years. But once in a while, something happens that kind of pushes you towards your limits. For me, during my first spacewalk, there was contamination in my suit, and it blinded my left eye for a while, and then it blinded both my eyes. So I was outside in the universe holding on with my hands blinded for what turned out to be about a half hour where I couldn't see. That was not what I expected to happen. But it wasn't a complete bolt out of the blue either. We'd practiced. I was outside with another fellow whose name was Scott, in fact, Scott Perezinski, and we'd practiced incapacitated crew rescue. We even have a name for it, because you never know what's going to go wrong, but you want to be able to drag the other person in and stuff him in the airlock and plug him into the ship's oxygen and keep him alive. So I knew we had that as a hip pocket procedure if we needed it. And when I really took inventory, it's like, okay, well, I'm not dead. I just can't see for a while, and hopefully this will get better. So it was a moment of considerable concern, but not really one of fear. I think the only time I felt real fear was coming south of Australia once, and we were just coming up towards Sydney, and it was nighttime. And as I was looking down at Australia, this was on board Atlantis, on the space shuttle Atlantis, and I watched a shooting star appear, you know, how they do, just a quick flash. But this was a big one. It lasted, one of those ones that lasts a few seconds. Mm-hmm. You can actually see something burning. And my first reaction was like you always do when you see a shooting star. I go, wow, look at that, a shooting star. But then I thought about it. Wait a minute, that's a big rock that just came screaming in from the universe at some incredible speed, 20 miles a second or something, and missed us and went through our orbit to get down to the atmosphere to burn up. And that randomness, that inability, no matter how much I prepared to control something like that, that actually sent a shiver up my back, my hairs to the back of my neck, saying thank you for not schmucking into the side of Atlantis. And I'll have a whole new thought about shooting stars from now on.
Did you see gravity?
I did. I was at the North American premiere of Gravity, in fact. So, yeah, I sure did.
How does Hollywood just absolutely, I mean, how close do any of those movies get in the moments when they are trying to be, you know, to create some verisimilitude? How close do they get?
In Gravity, the director focused really heavily on the visual reality of it, and he did a terrific job. I think he invented cinematographic techniques to try and show what it's like, the immense depth of what it's like to be out on a spacewalk, the three-dimensionality of it, the lack of up or down, the vastness of it, and the fact that the world's off to one side. That part of Gravity is the best part. The storyline and the laws
no George
of
Clooney ghost appearing to you.
No, the laws of physics, you know, got revoked. But it, you know, even Sandra Bullock described it as an amusement park ride. You know, and when I watch, whatever I watch Iron Man, I don't get all upset because you know, hey, that's not real. You know, it's a movie. It's not supposed to be real. I think the movie that was probably the closest was Apollo 13. But even it had to tell a whole story in 2 hours, so you have to oversimplify some stuff. But at least Ron Howard, when he made that movie, tried very hard to stick to things that actually happened and use the actual dialogue. And it gave a sense of the humanity of it, of the randomness of it, of how things really go, and of the triumph of human spirit. So I think of them all, it's the one that's most like what it's truly like to be an astronaut in space.
Most people, I think, recognize that astronauts have a great deal of science to learn. You have to learn all these training protocols. People may not be aware that you had to learn a whole new language in order to fly on Soyuz.
Yes, I was a test pilot out at Edwards in California, and then at Patuxent River in Maryland. And when I was hired, I'm Canadian, by the Canadian Space Agency, it was from being a military test pilot, and I used to intercept Soviet bombers as they were practicing cruise missile launches on North America. That was my previous life. I got hired as an astronaut in 1992, and the Soviet Union was coming apart, and it looked like NASA was going to cooperate with the Russian Space Agency, help keep them together, but also to take advantage of the great experience that they had. So there I am, brand new astronaut, 1992, 1993, and I'm thinking, this crystal ball looks interesting. Someday I may have a chance, despite my background, I may have a chance to fly on board a Russian ship or something. So time to start studying Russian. So in 1993, I started taking Russian lessons. I remember learning the alphabet and working my way through it and class by class. And I studied Russian for 19 years. And 19 years later, I had a chance to be the pilot of a Russian spaceship and fly the Soyuz.
Поэтому нужно говорить по-русски. Мы знаем это русский корабль, это не английский, это не французский корабль. Это наш профессор, нас учебники, все только по-русски. Но вы знаете, я не говорю по-русски, я говорю по Союзу.
I was the pilot of a Soyuz spaceship, and that was me in the background there. And it enabled me to do something that otherwise I never could have. Be able to operate a ship that is pretty incredible, great little ship that takes people up the station back, but also get to know a culture so much better, get to know the people so much better, and to go on and command the International Space Station with one more skill that'll hopefully allowed me to do the job a little better.
Did you have to feel like you were entirely fluent? Because, you know, in an emergency situation, people may or may not say things that you can understand. I mean, how this is not just a matter of picking up key phrases as relate to the living on the ship, right?
Oh, no. I was NASA's director of operations in Russia. I lived in Russia for four and a half years or so, and spent countless hours in classrooms one-on-one with a Russian professor who didn't know one word of another language trying to teach me orbital mechanics or Soyuz control theory. And I started originally on my own, then with an interpreter, of course, but then after a while weaned myself off the interpreter so I could just take all my classes purely in Russian. And then you start into the simulator by yourself until you get competent, and then you start integrated simulation with all of the support team and the other crew members and everybody working together, and you start with simple scenarios and then get more and more complicated until you have the cockpits full of smoke and the oxygen's leaking and you're doing an emergency deorbit and you're on page 201 of the emergency book on your entry checklist and you live and work completely in the language of that vehicle. We flew the space shuttle completely in English and we fly the Soyuz completely in Russian. It's just one of the things astronauts have to learn.
Is there any space term that you think just Russian handles much more elegantly than English?
They named their first spaceship Mir, which means both the world and it means peace. And I thought that there's lots of words in English that have two meanings or more, but I just thought what a lovely crossover that in the old Russian tongue, the word for Earth is also the word for peace. And how delightful. And what a lovely name for the first spaceship. And there's a great poetry in Russian. And why there have been so many good writers in the Russian language. You know, their politics are a mess, but the language and the people are beautiful.
My guest is astronaut Chris Hadfield, former commander of the International Space Station. He has a new book of photography out called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. We'll resume the conversation in just 2 minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Chris Hadfield, former commander of the International Space Station. He has a new book of photography out that he took from the ISS called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Chris, certainly you earned your way to all of the trips that you were able to take outside, off the surface of the Earth, but you have graciously acknowledged that you have had these experiences that most people will never get. Now we're talking about the commercial spaceflight industry, the idea that civilians could pay their way onto a carrier that takes them into space briefly. The accident last week certainly has caused some people to sort of cancel that. Are we ready for not just the majesty of space, but also for the relative risk of traveling into space as it stands in this early part of the 21st century?
Yeah, it's also new. We've only been flying in space less than the number of years I've been alive. Mm-hmm. And it's always been extremely dangerous. When we went back and did the math on my first space flight, you know, I flew in 95 on Atlantis on my first flight. And looking back now, we realized the odds of death during the first 9 minutes were 1 in 38.
Wow.
You know, pretty bad odds.
Yes.
We prevailed and had a very successful shuttle program through a huge amount of work and a lot of very skilled people. But we still got it wrong twice and lost two vehicles and two crews. And last week, we had two space-related accidents, one in an unmanned rocket ship launching out of Virginia, and then in the fledgling private space industry with Sir Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic. where the test pilot, one was killed and the other badly injured. We are obviously not ready for commercial passengers to be going up on those spaceships. Though they're still early. That's why there was a test pilot on board. I was a test pilot for many years, and I think my wife and I tallied it up. We lost one good friend a year as test piloting, and it's a dangerous job. But somebody has to do it, and if we wouldn't have safe aviation, if so many test pilots hadn't risked their lives and occasionally lost their lives in trying to figure out how airplanes work. But you could ask the same question. I don't know what year, Chris, maybe 1922, and say, are we ready for commercial aviation? And the answer would have been, well, no, not really. You know, the engines aren't very reliable. We don't understand streamlining. Nobody's invented a jet engine yet. We really don't know what we're doing. And we have no weather forecasting. We have no real navigation capability. But commercial aviation started back then, and it was only available to the very wealthy. But that's how it got going. Then came all the things that came along, safety regulation and a huge amount of investment by NACA, which was the predecessor to NASA, in streamlining and cooling, and then the invention of the jet engine. And finally, by the 50s, late 50s, early 60s, with the Boeing 707, suddenly there was this vehicle that was safe enough and efficient enough to start making air travel affordable and available and something that everyone could have access to. We're in the early stages of that, not with air travel, but with space travel. We're just in the transition phase where it's only test pilots who are taking those risks. Eventually, we'll, of course, get beyond it. And Richard Branson is investing a huge amount of the money that he's made to try and make this happen. He may be successful. I hope so. But it's still early days. And unfortunately, it's not any sort of simple guaranteed thing. It doesn't mean you quit.
Yeah.
But it's complicated.
We have an email here from Chad who wants to know what you think the space program will be like in 50 years.
Boy, 50 years. Yeah, that's the whole age of the whole thing.
Yeah.
50 years. Chad, it really depends on what we invent. It sounds sort of like a silly answer, but if you'd asked me in 1922, in 1972, what do I think air travel will be like? Oh, gosh, in 22, we had these little biplanes with ridiculously noisy and unreliable engines. Lindbergh, you know, it was just around the time the very first one of those flew across the Atlantic. It was early, early days. And I would have said, well, maybe someday we'll invent engines that work and maybe some really efficient ones. And then maybe we'll figure out how to pressurize an airplane so you can go up really high where the air is thin. You know, it's so much of the prediction of the future is completely reliant on inventions that haven't been made yet. So it's really hard to say. But when I'm trying to predict the future, all I do is extrapolate the past. So if we look back to where we were 50 years ago, basically 3 years after Gagarin, the very first human being, and Al Shepard, we had just started our very first orbits of the world. Since that time, we've had a dozen people walk on the moon. We have built a vehicle where 535 people have flown in space, most of them on the space shuttle. And we left Earth 14 years ago, not just probes going out, but people started living off the Earth 14 years ago this month, in fact, on the International Space Station. And not just one country, you know, as a demonstration of geopolitical will, but actually the whole planet working together to leave Earth. And then that's what the International Space Station is. So if I extrapolate that forward 50 years, I assume we will make some advances in engine design and in rocket technology, and we will go from orbiting the world on the International Space Station to sending probes to the moon to start setting up permanent habitation on the moon, just like we did in Antarctica over the last 100 years. A research station, a place to observe the world, try and understand how planets work and how the universe works and where. We don't even know what 94% of the universe is made of. We only know what 6% of the universe is made of, you know. But I would guess 50 years from now, we could do this interview from the moon with people that are living there. And there'll be some of our first permanent residents on hopefully what is international habitat on board, on the surface of the moon, as our first toehold on another planet, heading out into the solar system and the universe.
It'd be amazing. Studio time would be very expensive, but it would be amazing. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to the phone now. We have Mike on the line in Double Oak. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Chris. How's it going?
Very well, thanks.
I'm well.
Good. Thank you very much for taking my call. I was curious to learn a little bit more about what the physiological costs of being an astronaut are. I know that you get a radiation exposure and that all those months in the weightless condition takes a toll on bone mass, and you're very weak when you get back. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure thing, Mike. Yeah, weightlessness is like the ultimate laziness. You can be so idle without gravity. You literally don't have to lift a finger for 5 months, you know? Literally. You don't have to hold your head up. Your heart doesn't have to lift your blood anywhere. So your heart shrinks, your cardiovascular system changes, your balance system completely changes because it doesn't have gravity. And if you didn't do anything, your muscles would all waste away and your bones would get much less dense. You'd get osteoporosis. All of those things would happen. And that'd be fine, I think, if you were staying in space for the rest of your life. But since we want to return to Earth, or we have to do spacewalks sometimes, and they're really physical, so you have to stay strong. So we work out 2 hours a day, Mike, on various resistive exercise type equipment on board. And with that, you mentioned that I came home weaker. In fact, I came home stronger because I was having this healthy diet, you know, no fried food, no beer up there, a healthy diet, working out 2 hours a day. I came home about 20% just straight raw muscle strength, stronger. And I lost fat and gained muscle, so, you know, came back looking good. But even with that, I lost bone. We haven't got the equipment on board, the exercise equipment on board yet, that puts enough load on our hips and the bone in our thighs, the upper femur there, to maintain density. I lost about 8% of the bone density across there is what the doctors tell me, which is a lot. And we don't understand why. We don't know what is chemically or what the control mechanism is inside the body. So it's a really interesting area of study. And even more interestingly, since I got back, it's been reversing. So whatever that control is, your body automatically makes it happen without gravity and then does its best to reverse it when you get back. And it'll never be exactly the same. So you ask the long-term effects. You're right. I had an increased dosage of radiation and I lost some bone. My bone will grow back a little more like old guy hips, really, a little more of the calcified outer bone, less of the nice, soft inner trabecular bone. But immensely worth it. I mean, so what, right? I mean, you're not going to live forever anyway, and minor changes to your body happen whether you stay on the surface or drive a car or hide under your bed or go on a spaceship. So, yeah, there are changes, and we're learning about it, and we're testing a lot of stuff on the space station. And in fact, I had all my medicals with NASA this week to see how my body's doing, and I'm waiting to hear what my bone density results are to see if I can go skiing this winter or not. But yeah, it's one of the things we're studying. There are like 200 experiments up on the space station, and trying to understand how the body regulates itself is one of the key areas of study.
Is space pretty pain-free if you don't have some kind of active injury? Like you know, if you had a bad knee before, are you not going to feel that?
It'll be the ultimate spa at some point, Chris, where you can get into some sort of proven, reliable spaceship and 9 minutes later be weightless. And then hopefully go dock with something and stay there for an indefinite period. There are those sensory deprivation tanks where people are sort of floating on. You can't really tell even what you're lying on.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate version of that, where you can float weightless. If you have joint pain or if you're a person who's lost mobility for whatever reason, suddenly you can move your entire body around just with the brush of your fingertips. And you can, while you're doing that, you can be watching the whole world roll by underneath you. It's once we get all the kinks worked out of it and figure out how we can get there safely and back, I think it's going to be a real destination of choice.
So, Chris, I know that your days are pretty heavily scheduled, right? Because you have people in space,
yeah.
It costs a fortune. When you're on that treadmill for 2 hours a day, I mean, you're not watching The View. Do you have a computer in front of you, or how do you use that time?
We have three different pieces of exercise equipment on board. We have a stationary bicycle, and we have a treadmill. And the treadmill, there's big elastics that you have over your shoulders and across your waist. They hold you on the treadmill. And then there's just one of those, looks like a universal gym or something, one of those resistive exercise machines. On the universal gym, you're just kind of busy. You're up and down and changing positions. You can't really watch or do anything. But on your stationary bike or a treadmill, that I would read ahead on procedures on a computer screen in front of me. Or sometimes I would watch a hockey game. And the NHL was nice enough to send up hockey games with no commercials, so I could watch a whole game pretty quickly. And that I stole that time. I figured, I'm exercising and I can't really get any useful work done. So this is a time to see how my Leafs are doing.
You were really big on communicating via social media, and that's something that, you know, wasn't really available to previous generations of astronauts, the ability to be in kind of real-time communication with the world below.
It makes a huge difference. On my first space flight, I had a film camera, a Hasselblad, in fact, and ham radio. It's hard to mass communicate with a film camera and a ham radio, you know. And so I would take, say, a beautiful picture of the whole Dallas-Fort Worth area, or at least I think it was a beautiful picture because it's in a film camera. And then I'd have to wait till I landed, and then they would extract the film from storage on the vehicle, and then they'd process it. And a few weeks later, I'd get to see it, and then I'd look through the negatives, and I'd say, oh, I think this is the one. I'm not sure. And then they'd make a print of it, and I go, yeah, that's the one. Okay, I want – and then they'd make me a 35-millimeter slide of that picture of Dallas-Fort Worth, and now I've got this slide. Now, how do I share it with the people that are interested in it? It's so much more capable now. I could take that same picture now with the camera on board and within minutes plug it into a laptop, look at it, go, wow, you can see the whole thing. You can see one side to the other. You can see the reservoirs are a little bit full today, or you can see the river to the north on the border, or you can see all that, and hit send. And whoever on the world wants to see it that day, whether it's just people in Texas or anybody, they can join in and see what human exploration actually looks like. And that is an enormous advance. NASA put that technology on board, and I really did my best to use it to share the experience, because it is way too good to keep to yourself.
Why are we better at collaborating for space exploration across national boundaries than virtually anything else we try to do?
I think it's a feeling of being part of something larger than yourself. That is what everybody really wants. You know, people join gangs, people have affiliations and clubs and social groups and things that are often based on the desire to be part of something great, part of something new, part of something that is definitely larger than just the loneliness of being one person. And exploring the rest of the universe is immensely unifying. And the challenge is so high, and the consequences are high. And the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And the enemy of complexity, cost, and in the unknown has unified us like nothing else.
Astronaut Chris Hadfield's new book is called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. Chris, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for making time for us.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Lovely to talk with you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.